Coming up on Tech News Today, Lloyd Case helps us decide if those new NVIDIA graphics cards rock. They kind of do. Hacktivists are more of a threat than cyber criminals. We'll explain that one and why you should care about the new Photoshop. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, March 22nd, 2012. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. For a free trial and 30% off your new account for 3 months, go to Squarespace.com and use offer code TNT3. And by Ford, featuring Curve Control to help protect against crashes on curves. Look for Curve Control available in the 2013 Ford Taurus, and you can learn more at Ford.com/cars/Taurus. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Aya Zaktar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we kick around the tech news of the day, try to make some sense of it all. We got a couple of great guests joining with us today. Mr. Nate Langson, editor Wired.co.uk. Welcome. Good to have
you. Thank you.
Good to have you back. And thanks for staying up late.
It's 10 p.m.
Yeah, it's fine. Less late than
it's
it was
less late than
a
it
month
will
ago.
Be when you guys make your daylight saving change. And also joining us to talk about the new NVIDIA cards, but I think you're going to hang around for the rest of the show too, which is great. Lloyd Case, freelance writer.
Glad to be here.
And analyst at uncertainty.com. Good to have you back, Lloyd.
Good to be here.
Let's start off by talking about those NVIDIA cards. These are the new 28 nanometer Kepler cards. Of course, the big one is the desktop. The GTX 680, that's the one everybody's really excited about. Although the 600M line for the mobile ain't bad either. Lloyd, explain to us what's going on with the 680 desktop, because they've got some really cool things they're doing with clock speeds that make it more power efficient.
What they're doing is similar to what Intel does with Turbo Boost on their CPUs. They're allowing the clock rates to vary depending on power load and how much performance a particular game or application might need. So it defaults to the base reference card defaults to a little over a gigahertz, about 1,006 megahertz, if I recall correctly. But it'll boost up to about 1,058 megahertz. So you get about 5% more performance when you need it, assuming that it's not drawing too much power.
And it draws less power than the previous generation, 195 watts.
By a lot. I mean, it's 195 watts max. It has two of those little 6-pin connectors instead of one 8-pin and one 6-pin, which means you can use it with you don't need a mega power supply to drive this thing.
And it adjusts the clock speed every 13 megahertz? How does that work?
Well, those are just the default steps that it uses when it adjusts the clock rate up or down. So that's just the way NVIDIA set it up. It's based on how they set their clock speeds in terms of the circuitry they have built in for managing clocks.
So is this going to how is this going to affect me during gameplay? Is it going to smooth out the picture?
The clock rate boost is one interesting feature, but I don't think it's the main thing that people are going to see. It just has really great performance, even if it didn't vary the clock rate at all. Plus, they're doing a couple of interesting little tweaks to the way game frames are displayed. They have this thing called adaptive VSync. So one of the problems with playing a game is if you're playing at the monitor refresh rate, which for most LCD monitors is 60 hertz, and the frame rate of your game drops below 60 hertz, it drops in a big step, like down to 30 hertz. You see this big stutter. You'll see it sometimes in a game.
Yeah, I've definitely seen that.
So they have something called, if you turn VSync off, then you get this tearing, you get these weird lines across the screen at periodic times as the frame rates are refreshing it faster than the monitor speed. So what NVIDIA does is they say, okay, we'll run at VSync while the frame rate is above 60 frames per second, and so you get a smooth performance. And as soon as it drops below, we turn VSync off, and you still get smooth performance because it's the frame rate is degrading in a graceful way rather than in big steps.
And it can support 3-monitor gaming, and they have another interesting feature where you can have a fourth screen. It's a companion screen. It's lower resolution for things like chat and such, right?
Well, it can be anything. I mean, theoretically, given though, they have enough ports, and those ports will drive high enough resolutions that all 4 monitors could be full 1080p displays.
They could. Okay. See, yes. The way I was reading that is that fourth screen was not as not as capable, but that's cool.
That's sort of their usage model. What you're really doing is they can drive three monitors for gaming, and that fourth monitor can be doing anything else.
Gotcha. NVIDIA GeForce GTX 680 should be available immediately, priced at $499 in the U.S. Nate, for you, it's going to be £429, including VAT, 419 euros in Europe. Are you going to pick one up, Nate?
No, because I don't have a PC or a desktop. I'm MacBook Pro all the way.
You could just pick it up and have it.
You know, I could. It kind of defeats the purpose.
It does
use it as a paperweight.
Call me old-fashioned. I prefer my graphics cards in my machines. Just the way I am.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Pretty old school of him, but okay.
If you like, we're not here to judge. The other announcement, big announcement today is the 600M line, the mobile GPUs. Many of these are also 28 nanometer Keplers. The 600, I think it's the 600M is the one they're talking about as the higher powered one.
The 640, 650, and 660 are the Kepler ones, I believe.
Okay.
And the others are based on their older technology. So you got to kind of watch out. They're sort of rebranding everything to the same model numbers or the same line of model numbers. So you got to watch out what you get. If you want the 28 nanometer one, it's those three that are the 28 nanometer model.
Now, are the 620M and the 630M 28 nanometer but Fermi chips? Do I have that right?
No, they're not. If they're Fermi, they're 40 nanometer.
But
probably.
They are still 48. Yeah. Okay. Right. So you want, if you want 28 nanometer, if you want Kepler, you have to go 640 or up. But
right.
Again, these are mobile.
There's a baseline there. I believe the 680. No, I'm trying to look at their model number scheme now. But it's not that consistent. There's just those three models that are Keplers.
640, 650, and 660 are the Keplers.
Right.
But they're saying, do you believe this, that you would be able to run something like Battlefield 3 on an Ultrabook?
Well, that's using kind of a loose definition of an ultrabook. The thing they demoed at the Tech Day session that I went to was an ultrabook kind of in name only, in the sense that it is very thin, but it's actually a 15-inch unit that weighs almost 5 pounds. So it's kind of skating the thin edge of what an ultrabook really is. If you want something that's 3 pounds, 13-inch monitor, they don't quite have those there yet.
Gotcha. All right. Well, Lloyd, definitely appreciate you sharing your insights on this. If you want to learn more about this, folks, check out Lloyd's article at MaximumPC.com, Kepler Unveiled. You could read more about the NVIDIA cards there, because there's a whole lot more to say about these than we have time to cover. We're just kind of giving you the barest gloss on top. Let's move on to Verizon with a new report that they put out every year on hacking. This is something called the Data Breach Investigations Report. Now, they don't do this just based on their own network. They do this in cooperation with the United States Secret Service, the Dutch National High-Tech Crime Unit, Australian Federal Police, Irish Reporting and Information Security Service, the Police Central E-Crime Unit of the London Metropolitan Police. So this is a pretty comprehensive report. And what they found is, for the first time, more than 100 million of the 174 million stolen records that they tracked were stolen by hacktivist groups rather than your run-of-the-mill cyber criminals. So people doing it for a cause, not doing it for profit. According to the report, doubly concerning for many organizations and executives was that target selection by these groups, meaning the hacktivists, didn't follow the logical lines of who has money and or valuable information. Enemies are even scarier when you can't predict their behavior. Now, hacktivists did tend to focus on large, high-profile entities. So if you're a small business, you have to worry about the cyber criminals. If you're a large business, you probably have to worry about both. The report combined data from 855 incidents that involved more than 174 million comprised records, as I mentioned. The increase is due largely to the massive breaches penetrated by hacktivists. However, 96% of the penetrations were not difficult to accomplish, suggesting they would have been avoidable if companies had implemented basic security measures.
Was that just because the type of data that the hacktivists are going after isn't something that necessarily would be something they would be securing so well? Because it's almost like hacktivists want to go, look, we've taken as many gigabytes as we can to show you, you know what, you thought your data was safe. And even if you thought this data wasn't important, it is important. You can get a lot of information based on username profiles and all kinds of other sensitive data. That might not be something that these companies were even thinking were sensitive in the first place.
If the majority of the not difficult to accomplish hacks were limited to just the hacktivists and to a smaller percentage, maybe I could believe that. But since it's 96%, that means throw out the hacktivists. You still have a large majority of the cyber criminal hacks going after things that should have been secured. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's that, oh, well, we secured everything really well, except we left some stuff in less secure place because it wasn't that important. It's just companies are not properly securing their networks.
I think the whole idea of why a hacktivist would go after a particular company is also very interesting here, because it's if it's not for profit, it's more for public embarrassment or to prove a point. Then, yeah, they could be going after large batches of data that the company might say to their user base, well, don't worry, nobody got your credit card or anything. But that's not even necessarily the point. The point is to put the company in the news for something that's makes them look foolish.
Yeah, to embarrass them.
Yeah,
essentially. Smaller companies are breached more often through vulnerabilities and brute force attacks. Larger companies more often breached through social engineering and phishing. Nate, what do you make of this report?
You know, I'm kind of not surprised. I was thinking about this when I first saw the story, and I thought, well, last year it seemed like every single day there was another report of Lulzsec and, you know, and Anonymous, and I'm kind of not surprised that this report came out, you know, in favor of the hacktivists, you know, with the hacktivists coming out as stealing more data. I mean, it really did feel like 2011 was the year of the hacktivist. You know what I mean?
Now, how much of this, you know, a lot of the companies don't want to reveal when they've been hacked. And of course, the actual criminals don't necessarily want to advertise the fact that they're doing this hacking. So how much of it is just that the hacktivists really want to make it known what they've done?
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know how much the police organizations that Verizon works with on this report know about hacks that aren't reported. They may, or they may only be going on hacks that are reported to the police. And you're right. A lot of times large companies don't want to report an intrusion because they don't want people to know that their security was that lax and encourage other attacks.
That's the thing. Like the hacktivists, they want to make sure that people know. Like the hacktivists are the ones quite often reporting the fact that they've made these breaches because they want the publicity. You know, and I'm kind of curious as well what the definition, the specific definition in the report is for hacktivist versus criminal.
Yeah, that's something that we were debating before the show, importance of. Because, you know, I think you look at this and you say, okay, I know what a hacktivist is and I know what a cyber criminal is. But where that line is drawn could make a difference.
Yeah, there's probably some crossover.
Yeah. They're all probably engaging in criminal behavior, one could guess. Let's move on to new Photoshop CS6 coming out, and they're doing something they haven't done in a long time.
Yeah, for the first time actually in 7 years, Adobe has released a beta version of Photoshop ahead of the former release, and it is free. Photoshop CS6 beta is now available from Adobe Labs in both English and Japanese versions. Well ahead of the official commercial release, which we don't have a specific date, but Adobe has said expect it in the first half of this year in 2012. It'll be free. The official program will be free with a Creative Cloud subscription. That's kind of like Adobe's cloud service. That subscription would be $50 a month based on a yearly subscription. There will be standalone prices outside of Creative Cloud that have not been announced yet. CS6 will have both a regular version and an extended version, which has a few more bells and whistles, most notably 3D controls for a lot of 3D work. And what's interesting is Brian O'Neill Hughes, who's Photoshop Senior Project Manager, has made it extremely clear that the point of this free beta is to get as much feedback as possible from their user base because they've had so many feature requests in the past. It's like they want to add as many of those in while they're still in beta so that when the official release comes out, we are all happier. He says this is a very user-directed release. We're encouraging people to download the beta, experience it, provide us feedback. Adobe says that at least in this version, going forward already, has 60% more new features than the previous version, 65 user-requested enhancements, some software acceleration via something they call the Mercury Graphics Engine, which takes advantage of the graphics processor more than the main computer chip, especially helpful for those 3D controls in the extended version, and a bunch more tools. They've got something called Content Aware Patch, which seems to act a lot like the clone tool, but is more subtle. You can duplicate an area of an image to fill in or patch a different area of the same image. They have lots of work with layers. They now have vector layers that users can apply to dashed lines, gradient strokes, more easily layers that are searchable for people who work with deep within layers. Obviously, anybody who knows their way around Photoshop knows that layers can get a little confusing when you have a lot of them. So It's great. I think Adobe is really going the way. We've talked about a lot recently of companies saying, listen, we just want to keep our users happy. They need the users to go ahead and buy the full version of the program when it comes out in the next few months. And good on them. First time in 7 years.
Do we know how much this one's going to be? They haven't released any pricing
information. They haven't said so, yeah.
I mean, Although, if you do the Creative Cloud subscription...
Yeah, if you do the Creative Cloud subscription, it'll be free, but you'll be paying about $50 a month. But then you get, you know, a variety of services. The programs can talk to each other within the Adobe Creative Suite. You've got some cloud storage online. For anybody who wants to use data in the cloud and is a big Adobe products user, makes a lot of sense. But they will offer Photoshop as a standalone program as well.
One of the new features that I was most intrigued with is there's actually a video editor in Photoshop. So if you know how to use Photoshop, you can do some basic stuff right in that program. So there's no need to necessarily have a separate program or like Premiere Elements or anything else. You can just go, okay, I wanted to mess with this little clip. I mean, it seems like it's almost like a gateway drug towards Premiere in that kind of respect. But to take all the knowledge you have in Photoshop and to immediately apply that within the same program and color correction, all kinds of things. The Verge has a nice side-by-side image of how they've manipulated video. I'm excited about that kind of stuff because it's showing that, I mean, Photoshop is really powerful. Why not make it do a little bit more?
Yeah, and there are a lot of professional video editors who will tell you, oh, I do a lot of work in Photoshop. And then there's some conversion, and then I'll bring it into my timeline in some other program. But for people who use Photoshop or are comfortable within the program but aren't crazy video editors, just to have a little bit of that extra can be helpful because obviously you can create a lot of really stunning stuff within Photoshop.
Nate, Lloyd, either you excited about a new Photoshop?
No, sort of.
Go ahead. I'm sort of a limited Photoshop user. I have a pretty fixed workflow, and I tend to do just purely photographic things. Some of the new features are more suitable for people that are doing more or less general image editing. I don't also do a lot of video, so I'm right now content with 5.5. I'm probably going to boot up the beta, though, to check out anything new they might have, particularly with things like Camera Raw, which is sort of important to what I do.
There's they changed the way that they're doing the content-aware fill. So I've been using CS5 since it came out, and the content-aware fill is really cool if it works, and it sucks if it doesn't. You know, you can try and remove something and on a building, and it'll fill in the area that you've deleted, but with like a bit of sky, and that's really really frustrating. And what they've done in this version is you can select the area you want it to use to fill the area you're deleting from. So if it's a bit of brick, you can say, use this bit of brick to fill this gap.
That's pretty
cool. So I'm quite excited to try that out. I've not actually played with it yet.
Yeah, so anything you see after people start playing with this beta, be skeptical.
Yeah.
It's easy to Photoshop this stuff more than ever.
Pics means it didn't happen.
Yeah.
After this version of Photoshop. All right, let's take a quick break and thank our sponsor, Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog. Easy-to-use UI for creating and managing a website or blog. I use it all the time, every week. In multiple times a week, and it doesn't matter whether I'm on my laptop, whether I'm on my tablet, whether I'm on my phone. I can go in, I can update a post, I can create a post, I can make my blog work exactly the way I want to make it work wherever I am. It's really the easiest way to make a really good-looking website that is backed by reliable servers. So why not check it out for free? You don't have to give them a credit card. They're not trying to trick you into the service. They're not going to lock your data in. You can actually take out any data with you when you leave. Go check it out, squarespace.com. Try out the free trial, and if you decide to keep it, we're going to give you a break on that as well. No credit card needed. Like I said, try it out. If you decide to purchase it, use the offer code TNT3 and get 30% off for 3 months. That's squarespace.com. Use that offer code TNT3. Go get started today and tell Squarespace not only that you're interested in trying them out, but that you support the fact that they support us right here at Tech News Today. On to Pinterest in the news today. Fortune running a kind of a profile of the company, showing how they have grown incredibly fast. They're still in a garage. Can you believe that? They are the fastest growing website. And Ben Silberman just bought refrigerators for the garage that they're working in, according
to this story. Kind of a garage and a...
I imagine it's probably a bigger than a, you know, like a one-car garage. Yeah. It's probably a nice big...
tract home garage.
But it's got a ping-pong table in the back and a foosball table, and the ping-pong table is also where they do their conference meetings, according to this article.
Well, Pinterest grew faster than I think anybody could have predicted by a long shot.
A 52% jump in 1 month, according to ComScore, back in March, and it's not even open to everyone. It's still invite only. You have to get somebody to invite you in, and they're growing to 17.8 million users in 1 month. In February, Pinterest drove more traffic to websites than Twitter, Google+, LinkedIn, and YouTube combined. And the company raised $27 million from venture capital Andreessen Horowitz back in October, a deal that valued Pinterest at that time at a reported $200 million. So who knows what they'd value it for right now. The main point of this article that I think has everybody excited about and why everybody's blogging about it today, because everybody knows, oh, yeah, Pinterest, I've heard of it. I heard it's big. They just hired Tim Kendall, who spent many years as Facebook's director of monetization, which means, okay, we've got the users. How do we make money off these people? That's what Tim Kendall has been hired to figure out.
We've seen Facebook's numbers. I mean, they've made money. They figured it out. Like, you know, having a business plan when you have a ton of users is always good. I just still love that title. It makes me laugh. I mean, he was the director of monetization. I mean, you can never fire the guy. I mean, that's what he does. He makes you money.
Unless you're not making money.
Right, exactly.
Unless,
but at Facebook, he did a decent
you're in the
job.
Red.
So into Pinterest he goes.
Well, hey, if Tim Kendall replicates even a fraction of what he did at Facebook, can we expect to see some sort of right-hand bar on any sort of Pinterest page that has hopefully targeted links based on what we pin and what we like on other people's pins? That isn't the weirdest idea in the world. The only problem with Pinterest is user pages are already very busy. So it's nice to have them clean and ad-free, but I think that's probably something I'm
it might be easier.
In reality, I'm hoping for too much.
Wouldn't it be easier to hide ads in Pinterest then? Because you'd just see, like, you'd be looking around to see interesting things from your friends, and then you're like, there's an iPhone, and there's this thing. Oh, look, there's a Samsung Galaxy S3. You're like, oh, it's an ad.
Oh my gosh, you're right.
You should be director of monetization.
So there you go.
We're going to be rich. Wait.
Dang, I don't have the job.
They're going to be rich.
Good luck.
Does anyone have
a
Pinterest number?
You know, but Pinterest has all the hallmarks of being the next Facebook, which is why you're seeing this in all the headlines. They have a fantastic growth, rabid user base, and no one really understood why in the early days. Twitter, Facebook, none of these things. People are like, why is that so successful? It gets traction with a significant niche group. In this case, women in the Midwest were the ones who propelled it, and then everyone else starts using it for all kinds of things. The brands come in, start putting in their pages. Nate, where do you think Pinterest is headed? Is it a flash in the pan, or are they onto something? Are they going to be the next huge tech company?
Well, I don't think it's the next Facebook at all. I mean, I've never really liked the comparison between Twitter and Facebook. People saying, you know, they compete with each other. They do in a way, but they're totally different products. I think it competes more with Tumblr. You know, I mean, Tumblr is all about posting images, and it's mostly picture-driven stuff. And, you know, David Karp, who founded Tumblr, is like, you know, I don't have time to post this stuff. I just want to post some pictures and things like that. So I think it's a little bit more like that. And I think the idea of having sponsored pins is a really, well, it's a smart idea. I'd hate it, but it would probably make them a lot of money. And I think, you know, it's a really interesting site. The thing is, I haven't got on board with it yet. I've set up an account and I haven't used it. And for me, that's not a good sign. If I don't care about it, then
it doesn't exist. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, you know, not in an arrogant way, more in a kind of, you know, that sort of thing should appeal to me. And the fact that it doesn't, there's something that doesn't quite smell right. And I'm not sure what that is yet.
You know, one of the interesting aspects of Pinterest has been the whole copyright snafu, people putting up images that they just sort of clip from anywhere. And I think there's some opportunity for things like microtransactions or that kind of stuff. You know, put a copyright image, well, pay 3 cents and you're okay. And people don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, you pay for a $5 a year subscription to Pinterest and
right.
you're able to, you know, license from this pool of copyright images.
Right.
I could see
like that
happen. You know, one thing in this Fortune article that they mention is that Ben Silberman is such a polite, thoughtful guy. At least that's the way he's described by people, that when they complain about the fact that, you know, there are copyright issues here. And then he calls them and talks to them. They come back champions. They're like, no, this guy's trying to do the right thing. He's really respectful, and he's trying to make sure that the rights aren't being infringed. Mm-hmm. He is operating under the DMCA. And so it's a different kind of personality than, say, your Steve Jobs or your Mark Zuckerbergs, who are sort of antisocial in different ways. This guy's very... very much like, no, let me explain what we're trying to do here. We're going to try to help everybody.
You know, Kate in Oregon in chat says, unfortunately, Pinterest is already overrun with users posting sponsored items like, I love this. You'll love it too. Then it goes to an external link. So Anything's better than that. I know Pinterest is going to have to figure that out sooner than later.
All right, let's take a trip into the rumor mill.
Look, there's an Apple box again. Guess what? More Apple rumors. Okay. Here's the latest one out of South Korean publications reporting the next iPhone is going to have a gigantic 4.6-inch Retina display.
Crap!
That's right. The newspaper cites, guess what? An unnamed industry source. Do you believe it now, Tom?
Well, obviously. Well, now I have to.
And Reuters says the launch would be in the second quarter of this year, but a translation of the original report says summer, so it would show up there. If you're wondering about why would they have a 4.6-inch display, Samsung already makes a 4.6-inch OLED display they put in their S2, and Samsung does provide displays for Apple, so it's not impossible. And according to Krishna Sagar, a tipster writing to iDownload blog, he noticed that Apple has in iOS 5.1 notes about a 4G LTE iPhone. So it could make sense if you have a large screen with a big battery to support that LTE. But 4.6-inch display, John Gruber saying that's bull spit, except that wasn't the word he used. Different
other end.
Right, exactly. Considering the display would pack in more pixels than the current display, he says that the change would require every app to be redesigned and resized. Though that might not be true, because I was doing some math today.
Math was hard.
Yeah, math was fun. So if you remember when they introduced the new iPad at Apple, they showed the Retina display for the iPad had a lower pixel per inch because it was at a further distance.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed the iPhone. The iPhone was at 10 inches at 3.5-inch display. If you move to a 4.6-inch display, you have to hold it a little further out. So like maybe like 12 to 14. So you probably could get away with having the same resolution.
As long as you're farsighted.
Same resolution with a lower PPI, and it still would be a Retina display, so it's possible.
But that's silly.
Yes, absolutely. This is mathematically possible, but silly. Absolutely.
A bigger phone where it's like, just hold it farther away. It's fine.
But they said this about the iPad 3, the new iPad, is that it's still a Retina display because mm-hmm. although the pixels per inch was fewer than the one in the iPhone 4, they did some maths and it still worked out as a Retina display. Like you hold it at 10 inches and it was still Retina. So it could still work, I think, unless you did math and you proved me wrong, which it sounds like you did.
The math would be, I think for the 4.6 would have to be somewhere like 12 to 14 inches away. So normally you hold the iPhone 10 inches and then the iPad 15 inches. So they would have, this is a great, I wish, can we get Sarah's, like, yeah, that's pretty much the reaction. I think 4.6 is too big, by the way. I think 4.3.
I think in terms of rewriting applications, too, I think if they increase the aspect ratios by the same percentage, I mean, if they increase the horizontal and vertical pixel quantity by the same amount, then rewriting it would have to be minimal. They could scale it up.
It's possible that they could, but Apple doesn't like to do that except for the doubling. And even then, they want there to be native resolutions. They don't like it to stay with the doubled resolutions. At least they haven't with the iPad. But you know, who knows?
Well, and they also made that transition from the original iPhone to the iPhone 4, right? So
yeah, with the proportional increase. You're right.
And there was this weird concept someone was saying, like, what if it's only half the resolution of the current iPad, like 1024 by whatever it is? But that would change the aspect ratio to 4:3. Could you imagine a 4:3 iPhone? It looked like one of those.
That I don't think they would.
That would
seem
bizarre.
That's too hard to adapt to. All right. Let's finish up with Apple and Nokia in a tussle over micro SIM cards. Financial Times reported a while back that Apple is seeking to get its own nano SIM proposal approved over a competing proposal that is being put forth by Nokia, Motorola, and RIM. Next week, ETSI, the European Telecommunications Standards Institute, not the craft place, decides on the 4FF, the fourth form factor. And Nokia has put forth their objections to the Apple design today with three main objections. They say that Apple's proposed card is the same length as the width of the current micro SIM, meaning that if it's accidentally put in sideways, it would risk getting jammed, leading to card and product damage. When combined with the associated mechanics needed inside the phone, they actually don't believe that it's a significant reduction in size. So the card may be smaller, but the device inside the phone needed to read it would take up the rest of the space and would end up taking just as much space as the current micro SIM. Nokia also says their option allows for more design flexibility. That may or may not be true. They also say that the total nano SIM package, including the phone components needed to read it, is smaller in the Nokia proposal and doesn't require a tray. Now, Financial Times had reported that Apple's proposal would require a drawer of some sort, kind of like what they have in the iPhone, and this seems to back that up. So we've got a little head-to-head over micro SIMs. I don't know why. I guess we need a micro SIM so that we can make thinner phones. I'm all for that. I haven't been able to review these proposals, so I can't say what I think about them directly. But Nokia is making a fair argument.
Yeah, I mean, considering this is the Standards Institute at Etsy here, they're not going to go, oh, you know what? You can jam it by accident. That seems a little crazy. I mean, I don't know if Apple is just short-sighted in this concept. But I mean, it's
Apple's going to come back and say you can't jam it.
You can't?
Yeah.
That's the thing about SIM cards, though. They're built a certain way. They only go one way, just kind of like SD cards. It's supposed to be kind of idiot-proof. And if you allow the idiot element in, well, it's going to screw up things. I'm pretty sure Etsy is going to say, Nokia, you win.
Allow the idiot element in, please. All right, let's move on to the news views. A Netflix representative told Mashable that the company plans to introduce HD video for the new iPad, but could not give specifics on the timing. Oh, well. The Netflix iPad apps still only display standard definition, but Netflix on Apple TV was upped to 1080p, so they got the video there. They just need to get it over to the iPad. According to Mashable, the only streaming video app that displays 1080p video on the new iPad is the app from ABC.
Oh, my gosh. Somebody just liked something of mine on Facebook. Let me see what it is. Cool. Oh, it's Patton Wars. Facebook just bought 750 patents from IBM. At least so says a person with knowledge of the transaction, according to Bloomberg. The patents are said to cover various tech around software and networking. The acquisition would considerably beef up Facebook's stack of patents, which right now includes around 56 issue patents and 503 filed U.S. patent applications.
What's that over yonder, over the horizon? Could it be patent peace?
No, not patent wars.
There we go. There it is. Well, Microsoft and TiVo have removed their weaponized patents from each other's heads. TiVo announced the settlement in a regulatory filing and said the company didn't grant Microsoft any patent rights. Now, Microsoft's withdrawal of its patent suit seems to be tied up to a dispute AT&T and TiVo had, as in Microsoft was defending AT&T. The dispute was settled back in January. So no more patent stories ever.
Major Nelson says Minecraft is coming to the Xbox 360. 4J Studios will handle the porting of the game, which will be released on May 9th. The 360 version will be able to take screenshots and use Kinect, although Kinect support will not be there on launch day. The game will cost $20, which translates to about 1,600 Microsoft points.
Lookout Labs, a security firm, says that Americans lost approximately $30 billion worth of mobile phones in 2011. The study was about actually physically losing a phone or having it stolen. The top city for phone losers is Philadelphia. I'm very sorry, Philly.
City of brotherly love.
Rounding out the not very brotherly.
Not at all.
Not a lot of love. Rounding out the top five are also Seattle, Oakland, big surprise, Long Beach, California, and Newark. I love Oakland. I'm just saying.
Some neighborhoods in Oakland don't lose any phones. Okay?
That's correct,
Tom. It's a big city.
You're right. I shouldn't generalize. Lookout Labs makes software for phones that helps people find their lost phones, by the way. So,
data from IDC says RIM is now the number two smartphone shipper in its home country of Canada for the first time.
Number two.
The iPhone is now the king of the Canucks. Maybe RIM sees the writing on the wall because All Things D dug up a job listing at RIM for iOS developers. Well, probably BBM is coming to iOS. That's probably.
Really? It's coming to iOS for
that's,
sure?
No, that's okay. Probably. Unless maybe RIM is moving to iOS entirely.
RIM is moving to Cupertino. After a server crash took down a Norwegian government site that helps deliver tax results to citizens, people who tried to log in found themselves logged in as Kenneth, a 36-year-old man from Oslo. Every single person was Kenneth, which means those people had access to Kenneth's personal financial information for the past 2 years. The site was shut down after 15 minutes. It is not known how many people got poor Kenneth's information.
Poor Kenneth, indeed.
I know.
Jeez. Retina display? Microsoft's got your Retina display right here. David Washington, a senior program manager on the Windows 8 user experience team, posted that Microsoft's forthcoming operating system will scale to differently sized and more pixel-rich screens. In addition to a minimum screen resolution capability of 1024 by 768, Washington said that many of the coming Windows 8 tablets will have pixel densities of at least 135 DPI, with some HD tablets and quad XGA tablets going as high as 190 DPI and 253 DPI, respectively.
Let's spin up the randomizer.
Oh,
well, hang on. Wait a minute. Oh. Don't spin up the randomizer.
No, wait.
Because it's layoff day, apparently.
TV. Hold on. Hold that randomizer.
We have that randomizer held? Okay, let's go to layoff day.
Apparently. No, let's not go to layoff day.
I was trying to avoid that.
T-Mobile USA CEO Philip Hum sent a memo to his employees today announcing the elimination of 1,900 jobs nationwide, primarily resulting from the closure of 7 call center facilities across the ocean. Nokia finalized a long-anticipated plan that will see 1,000 of its employees in Finland lose their jobs, and Seismic cut its staff in half as well. Why do you people make me read the bad news?
I was trying to avoid it.
Let's go to fun land of randomizer.
Yeah, let's do that.
Randomizer.
Einstein's complete archives have gone online for the first time. Kind of like Kenneth, except intentionally. The leading pioneer of the atomic age finally touching down in the information age, says Damon Porter over at PC Mag. So if you are interested in some of the 80,000 items that have only recently been cataloged and enhanced with cross-referencing technology, now's the time to go check them out. This is fantastic. You go to the Einstein Archives online portal at alberteinstein.info. Look at that. Even a good use for a .info domain name, finally.
I'm in.
Is it really a good use?
It's Einstein. This is going to be huge for historical science people.
There is no good use for a .info domain name. But this is really this is really cool, though. I mean, I'm all for this. But I want it as an app. I want to be able to read it on the tube.
Well, just bring it up in your browser.
Bring it in your browser. Hit read later. Because that's what I was staring
copy,
at.
Copy, download, ignore .info domain. Now, this is awesome. I'm really excited about this.
Yeah, this is cool. There's a help from a grant from the Polonsky Foundation UK assisted in the digitization of Isaac Newton's papers previously, so they helped put this together as well. It's a fantastic treasure trove of historical information for folks out there. Let's take a quick break and thank our other sponsor, Ford, featuring Curve Control, the new Ford Taurus. It helps drivers maintain control of their vehicle when taking a curve too quickly. Here's how it works. Now, you won't know this is happening. You're just going to be driving and driving around the curve. But just to make sure you're driving safely, the vehicle checks how quickly the vehicle is turning, how quickly the driver is trying to turn it. It calculates the roll rate, the yaw rate, the lateral extension, the wheel speed, and the steering angle 100 times every second. And if it finds a problem, it will reduce engine torque, apply four-wheel braking, and slow that vehicle down as much as it needs to, up to 10 miles per hour in 1 second. Works on whether it's raining or not, wet or dry pavement, doesn't matter. Curve control helps protect while driving on curves. And it's just one of new driver assist technologies available in the 2013 Ford Taurus to make your driving safer. And as Leo's always saying, it shows that Ford's an engineering company. They're looking to make the car use technology to make your driving experience better. So go test drive a 2013 Ford Taurus today or learn more about curve control at Ford.com/cars/Taurus. Let's check the calendar.
Dun, da, da, da. Do you want a Galaxy Tab 10.1 with an LTE plan?
Sure do.
You can get one today on, can you guess?
AT&T?
No. Well, yeah. Well, no. But
where?
Not Sprint.
Where can I get one?
Not T-Mobile. U.S. Cellular.
Oh, right.
Yeah. AT&T also announced today that it's making the Android 4.0 ice cream sandwich update available for the HTC Vivid smartphone, making it the first carrier in the U.S. to issue an ice cream sandwich upgrade on a device that originally shipped with gingerbread. So it's happening. Also in Android news, Sony tablets are getting an Android 4.0 update at the end of April. Also, the Wi-Fi-only tablet P has announced April 1st in Japan. 20%. Jason, this is something that you liked, correct?
I think I refer to it as the tablet PU.
Yeah, didn't like it.
Oh, you didn't like
no,
it.
No, I didn't care for it.
PU.
Check it.
Well,
Sorry, Sony.
People in Japan don't like it.
Try again.
And another Android news, Samsung Galaxy Note will not get ice cream sandwich until quarter two of this year. So if you were holding your breath, please stop, because we want you to stay with us. The Panasonic Eluga gets the official launch date in Japan and Europe, and it is April 29th on NTT Domoko.
I haven't seen a phone from Panasonic in a while. That's cool.
A Republic Wireless Beta is going to reopen to new users in June. That's that unlimited phone service through a combination of Wi-Fi and Sprint cell phone network for $19 a month. Some restrictions, but definitely a very cool concept. And finally, tomorrow is something that a lot of people aren't going to want to participate in, but you maybe think about it. It's the National Day of Unplugging. The challenge is to abstain from tech from sunset tomorrow, March 23rd, until the following day's sunset, March 24th. That's 24 hours.
It's a Sabbath of unplugging.
Unplugged. And it is indeed a Sabbath of sorts.
See, I was kind of thinking it would work better if it just meant unplugging your phone from the charger and your tablet or your laptop from the charger.
And the battery life these days.
Yeah.
A cinch.
Yeah, you'd make it.
Not a problem.
All right, who let's go around the table. Who's participating? Lloyd, you're going to participate in unplugging?
Only in the sense that I'll be in a bus to San Diego for 10 hours tomorrow.
So sort of by voluntary unplugging.
Right.
Nate, what about you?
I'm all about the Wi-Fi. I don't need cables anyway.
Okay, I think you guys are missing the point.
This is a digital detox.
Oh, no, I can't unplug.
Yeah.
Are you
Sarah?
Kidding?
How could I do the show?
Well, from evening Friday until evening Saturday, no show.
No, I'm not participating in this. I like to work ahead.
I like to plug.
I will not be participating in this.
I can't. I got to do autopilot at 1 p.m. I wouldn't be able to do my show.
So then this is a success.
Yeah. 1,300 people have taken the pledge to do it already, so we're just not those
1,300 people are better people than we are.
Good for you guys.
Let's check what's incoming.
Incoming message.
Got a voicemail pointing out something we missed about HP's MagCloud printer. You don't have to have one yourself. Check it out.
Waiting. Come on, SoundCloud. Go ahead and play it.
Do it.
You can do it.
Do it.
You can do it. We believe in you. If everyone believes, it'll play.
Come on, little Cloud.
Hey, guys. Was calling about your discussion of MagCloud. It's actually more like Google, where they'll print and ship the magazine to you. They'll also do Excel Stitch Binding, which is our second biggest telescope, and Brick and Pound Binding. So that's actually very nice. So you're not actually using your own ink, you're using theirs. So I just wanted to correct you guys a little. Thanks. Bye.
Right, that actually makes more sense to me. It's like I need a couple of these printed, so I don't need to use a whole big service like Lulu that distributes it to bookstores. But I do need a couple of permabound books printed. Order from MagCloud. Makes sense. Thanks for the voicemail. Also, I got some emails about the bird wings. And in fact, the first one that I'm going to read is from CJ Land, who pointed out via email that the creator of the Flying Birdman has come out admitting it was, in fact, a hoax.
Today on Dutch television.
Yeah. Wired has the story. Essentially, he planned it, which is why he had so many months and months of posts about it. He has been working on it for 8 months. It's an experiment about online media. Mr. Jarno Smeet's name is actually Floris Cake, and he has done previous hoaxy-like film experiments in the past. He created a hoax documentary about a fake disease called Metalysis Maligna that caused medical implants to grow and overtake the body. That was also a hoax. So he went on Dutch TV today and admitted, yes, this was in fact fake, although he didn't talk about how he did the fake. I did send out notes to visual effects artist lists, or I got a friend of mine to do it for me, and we got lots of responses from that. They were universally skeptical, so they didn't get taken in. Jonathan Lightens wrote a blog post up at comedyforanimators.com where he points out the easy ways it could have been faked and the suspicious focus shift on takeoff, the blurriness on landing. Sam Edwards also wrote in to me saying he saw a lot of tire tracks on the ground, suggesting there was a tow vehicle and that they had done several takes towing it out, which would make the glider work. I thought that was a particularly good observation. So I'm curious to find out how they actually pulled it off. I hope they reveal that as part of the experiment.
So the whole point was to draw attention to what, online media?
I think it was not to draw attention to as in to promote, but to see how people reacted to
it. Well, people reacted with a lot of links, a lot of sharing. So I guess you got your point across, but now everyone's just mad at you.
Yeah, but he's not trying to get a point across. I think he's trying to see what did people do, and then he's studying us.
No, I get what subjects. He's doing. I'm still saying this stinks. I wanted like it to be subject. Real.
That's why. Yeah, yeah, I know. We wanted to go fly it, actually.
It's a kind of performance art, I guess.
Yeah. Did you watch it, Lloyd?
Yeah, and, you know, I saw that and I said, I have sort of my hard science background said, I'm not so sure about this.
Yeah, I liked the reaction that the internet had. I liked the skepticism and the analysis and the sort of holding off on making a judgment and saying, you know, the guys at MythBusters are like, we're skeptical. We don't believe this is real, but we can't find any evidence of it yet. So he obviously did a really good job of it. I'm curious to see how he pulled it off. Nate, did you get sucked in as well?
No, but I actually didn't watch the video, but I just loved your debunking on yesterday's show about how the head nodding didn't seem to line up from his head cam to the camera on the ground. I thought that, you know, that's some damning evidence right there.
Back and to the left. And to the left.
It's brilliant.
All right. Well, that's it for this edition of Tech News Today. Thanks, everybody, for watching or listening. Thanks to everybody who submits stories in our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. You know, if you submit a story and you don't see it show up in one of the big lists, there's a lot of stories being submitted. So you may have just submitted something that is too similar to something else, but it wasn't exactly the same link, so it didn't get flagged. But keep submitting those stories and definitely keep voting on things, whether you'd like to see them. Vote up or down, technewstoday.reddit.com. Lloyd Case, thanks so much for joining us and talking about the NVIDIA cards and hanging around for the rest of the show. It's always good to have you around.
My pleasure. Talk to you later.
Let folks know before you go about uncertainty.com.
Yeah, uncertainty.com is my new blog, which I'm posting maybe once a week right now. I'm writing lots of other articles for other sites, so I'm pretty busy. You can also always get a hold of me on Twitter, just at Lloyd Case.
Excellent. And Nate Langston, always good to have you around as well. Thanks for staying up late for us again. Of course, you can find your great works at wired.co.uk. Anything in particular coming up we should know about?
I would just say we have a podcast, and I think it's pretty great. I host it with Duncan and Olivia from Wired as well. If you search for Wired UK on iTunes, you will find it. Give it a listen. I think it's pretty cool.
You can find us on the web, twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, tnt@twit.tv, or give us a call. Our phone number is 260-TNT-SHOW. Darren Kitchen joins us for Friday tomorrow. We'll see you then.